Hello, and welcome back to What the Health. I'm Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for KFF Health News, and I'm joined by some of the best and smartest health reporters in Washington. We're taping this week on Thursday, April 11th at 10 a.m. As always, news happens fast, and things might have changed by the time you hear this. So here we go. We are joined today via video conference by Alice Miranda Olstein of Politico.
Hello.
Rachel Korzang of Stat News.
Hi, everybody.
And we welcome back from her leave, Rachel Rubine of The Washington Post.
Hi, happy to be here.
Later in this episode, we'll have my interview with my KFF Health News colleague, Molly Work, about the latest KFF Health News NPR Bill of the Month, about yet another very expensive air ambulance ride that an insurer deemed, quote, unnecessary. As you will hear, that is hardly the case. But first, this week's news, and there is lots of it. We start again this week with abortion because, again, that's where the biggest news is. I want to do this chronologically because there are a lot of things that happened and they all built on each piece before them. So on Monday, former President Trump, as promised, issued his long-awaited statement on abortion, a four-minute video posted on his platform Truth Social, in which he took credit for appointing the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, but then kind of declared the job done because abortion is now up to the individual states. And while he didn't say so directly, that strongly suggested he would not be supporting efforts by anti-abortion groups to try to pass a federal 15-week ban should Republicans retake the presidency in both houses of Congress. That alone was a big step away from some of his strongest anti-abortion supporters, like the SBA list, which helped got him elected in 2016. Right, Alice? I see you nodding.
Yes, he kind of left himself some wiggle room. He made a statement that at first people could sort of read into it what they wanted. And so you had several anti-abortion groups going, well, he didn't advocate for a national ban, but he also didn't rule it out. But then, as I'm sure we'll get to, he was asked follow-up questions and he kind of did rule it out. He kind of did say, no, I wouldn't sign a national ban if it were presented to me. And so the little crumbs of hope anti-abortion groups were picking up on may or may not be there. But it was both notable for what he did say and what he didn't say. There are still a lot of unanswered questions about what he would do in office, both in terms of legislation, which is really like a remote possibility that no one thinks is real, but he didn't say
anything. It would
need
60 votes in the Senate.
Exactly.
Legislation. Yeah.
Exactly. And no one really on the right or left thinks that is going to happen, but he didn't say anything about what he would do with executive powers, which, as we've discussed, could go a long, long way towards banning abortion nationwide.
One of the things that sort of fascinates me, I've been covering abortion for a long time, longer than some of you have been alive, and I have seen lots of politicians switch sides on this. I mean, Joe Biden started out as very anti-abortion, now very, you know, in favor of abortion rights. So I've seen politicians go both ways, but the general rule has always been you get to switch once. You get to either go from being pro-life to pro-choice or being pro-choice to pro-life. You don't get to go back and forth. And yet that seems to be very much what Trump has done. He seems to have taken every conceivable position there is on this extraordinarily binary issue and gotten away with it.
One last thing I wanted to flag in the statement was that he kind of said the quiet part out loud and then he directly said that this is about winning elections. So he's saying this is what we need to say in order to win, which leaves open, you know, what he really believes or what he really would do.
Yeah, I mean, going back to Trump's shifting view on abortion, because that's really important. That's something that, like, you know, the anti-abortion movement is sort of looking towards. I mean, in 1999, in an interview in Meet the Press, he called himself very pro-choice. And then, you know, we kind of saw by 2016, he had committed to naming justices who had anti-abortion views. And as Alice mentioned, then after like the midterms in 2022, he, you know, blamed Republican losses on that.
Yeah, I assume that makes it hard for people who try to follow him. I know Lindsey Graham came out, you know, Lindsey Graham, who's been sort of the major backer of the 15-week abortion ban in Congress for some time now. And, you know, suddenly Lindsey Graham, who has been nothing but loyal to Trump, finds himself on the other side of a big, important issue. I mean, Trump seems to get away with it. The question is, are his followers going to get away with having different positions on this?
Oh, I also just wanted to say that I think it'll be interesting to see who Trump chooses as his running mate on this, because obviously his opinion and his position is very important. But I think we saw kind of last time around with him leaning on Mike Pence a little bit for credibility with the anti-abortion movement. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether he chooses someone again who can mend some of these relationships, or, you know, whether he's just going to carry on and make those decisions himself and lean less on his VP.
Well, let's move on to Tuesday, because on Tuesday, the Trump abortion doctrine got a pretty severe test from the Arizona Supreme Court, which ruled that an almost absolute abortion ban that was passed in 1864, before Arizona was a state, before the end of the Civil War, can be enforced. Alice, what's this law and when might it take effect?
So the Supreme Court kicked some of those issues back down to the lower court, and so it's still being worked out. Currently, abortion is banned after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The total ban could go into effect in a little over a month, but it's really uncertain. And so you're seeing a lot of the same fear and confusion that we saw in the immediate aftermath of Dobbs, where providers and patients don't know what's legal and whether they can provide or receive care, and are in some instances over complying and holding off on doing things that are still legal. And so just a great example of how Trump and these national political figures, they can take whatever position they want, but that often gets overtaken by events. And so you saw Trump come out and say states should decide. This is arguably an instance of states deciding, although the Supreme Court upholding a law from when no one was currently alive was part of that. The law was implemented when women couldn't vote, when Arizona wasn't even a state yet. So whether this is an example of will of the people, that can be debated. But this is an example of leave it to states. And then Trump was asked about the Arizona decision, whether it went too far. And he said, yes, it did go too far. So it's like, should states be allowed to decide or not?
It's like, leave it to states unless they go too far.
And who decides what too far is? Because a lot of anti-abortion groups were very complimentary of the Arizona ruling and said it was the right thing to do. So depends who you ask.
So this obviously scrambles politics beyond just the presidential race, although I think it's pretty clear to say that it puts Arizona, which had been teetering as being sort of purple state-ish, right back in play. But it's going to affect things down the ballot in another state, right?
I mean, just looking at Arizona, I mean, abortion rights and Democrats have really been pushing ballot measures here. And, you know, I think as Julie was alluding to, there's a ballot measure effort in Arizona. And I believe the organizers have said that they have enough signatures to qualify. You know, then there's, you know, steps to actually qualifying. So that's going to, you know, really put a spotlight on Arizona. But, you know, we've seen ballot measures in other states. Florida, Democrats really want Florida to be in play now that there's been a Florida state Supreme Court ruling. And there's a ballot measure there. The threshold's higher at 60%. But, you know, all around the country, it's going to be putting increasing emphasis on this ballot measure effort.
So Republicans now really have no place to hide. I saw there was a Senate candidate in Wisconsin who had been very completely anti-abortion, now seems to be a lot less anti-abortion. I mean, Republicans have spent a lot of time putting Democrats on the spot about not wanting to be specific on their abortion position. And that's what leads to the you support abortion, you know, up until the ninth month, which isn't a thing. But now I feel like it's a chance for Democrats to kind of turn this on Republicans, saying now you have to say exactly what your position is rather than just you are quote unquote anti-abortion or quote unquote, you know, 100% pro-life, which for many, many elections was plenty and all that candidates needed to say.
Just as we talk about all of these different, how this is playing out, like certainly I think the instance you brought up was an example of kind of a position on the larger issue of what a candidate is going to support generally. But I think there are these kind of tangential local issues too that candidates are going to have to take positions on. I think if we look back like IVF, you know, that's something that candidates have not really had to weigh in on. And I think it is going to become local in a new way, which just seeing all these offshoot rulings and court decisions. And I think that was an excellent catch. And certainly it'll be interesting to see kind of how candidates move across the spectrum as we see some more and more extreme you know, local cases coming up even beyond the national standard.
And as Alice points out, this is more than just political. This affects healthcare on the ground, doctors either not wanting to train in states that have strict bans, or doctors in some cases picking up and leaving states, not wanting to be, you know, threatened with jail or loss of license. So that affects what other kinds of women's health care is available. Alice, you want to add something?
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of people saying, both with the Florida ruling and with the Arizona ruling. So in both of these instances, a very sweeping abortion ban is expected to go into effect, but then there's going to be a ballot referendum in the fall where voters will have the opportunity to get rid of those bans. And so you're seeing a lot of people saying, okay, well, this is only temporary. Voters will be so outraged over this that they'll vote to support these ballot measures to overturn it. But I think it's important to remember that a lot of the impacts will linger for a long time. If these clinics can't hang on even a few months under a near total ban and shut their doors, you know, you can't just flip a switch and turn that back on. It's incredibly hard to open a new abortion clinic.
Or even to reopen one that you've closed down, quote unquote, temporarily.
Exactly. And like you said, medical students and residents and doctors are making decisions about where to live and where to practice that could have impacts that last for years and years. And so people saying, oh, well, it's not that important if these bans go into effect now because in November voters will have their say. Even a few months can have a very long effect in a state.
Yeah, I just want to continue to reiterate, this is about more than politics. This is actually about healthcare on the ground. Well, in other abortion news, a three-judge panel of the Indiana Court of Appeals ruled last week that the state cannot enforce its abortion ban against a group of plaintiffs who are non-Christians and charged that the ban violates their freedom of religion because some religions, notably Judaism, but others too, include tenets that prioritize the life and health of the pregnant woman over that of the fetus. This is obviously not the last word on this case. It could still go to the Indiana Supreme Court or even the U.S. Supreme Court, but it does seem significant. I think it's the first decision we've seen on one of these cases, and it was unanimous. And interestingly, it turns a lot of the recent decisions protecting religious freedom for Christians right back on those who would ban abortion. Alice, there are more of these in the sort of awaiting hearing, right?
Yes, there's ones going on really around the country that are testing these legal theories. And part of it is that state-level religious freedom laws are often more expansive and protective than federal religious freedom laws. And so they're leaning on that. And yeah, it's a really fascinating test case of, were these religious freedom laws intended to only protect one particular religion that has hegemonic power in the United States right now? Or were they designed to protect everyone of every religion? And I think Judeo-Christian values is a term that's thrown out a lot. And this really shows that there are very different beliefs when it comes to pregnancy and abortion and which life to prioritize between the mother and the child and when it even counts as an abortion, when it even counts as life beginning. That is a lot more muddled. And look, in this case, it was led by Jewish plaintiffs challenging, but I've been tracking cases that draw from many different religions. And these protections even apply to avowed atheists in some instances. And so I think this is definitely something to keep an eye on. In addition to Indiana, the other case I've been following most closely is in Missouri. So it'll be really fascinating to see what happens.
There was one in Kentucky, too. I wonder, did anything ever happen with that one? I think that was the first one we talked about.
They're still
like
waiting.
Two years ago.
Yeah. The wheels of justice turn slowly.
Indeed, they do. Well, finally, Tennessee is on the verge of enacting a bill that would require students to be shown a 3-minute video on fetal development and strongly recommends one made by the anti-abortion group Live Action. Not surprisingly, medical experts say the video is inaccurate and manipulative. I will post a link to it so you can watch it and judge for yourself. What jumped out to me in this story is that one Tennessee lawmaker, himself a physician, said, and I quote, "Whether all of the exact details are correct, I don't think that is important." Is that where we have come with this debate these days, that facts are no longer important?
I mean, I thought it was interesting that there was an amendment rejected that would have allowed parents to opt out of it. And I just feel like there's so many permission slips in schools these days for like any book or movie that something like this would be mandated. It's just kind of like a interesting twist on that. So again, we'll be interested to see if it actually like takes effect. But
I mean, it's a pretty benign video. It's basically purporting to show fetal development from the moment of fertilization, you know, up to birth. The big complaint about it is it's misleading on the timing because it's counting from a different place than doctors count from. It's counting from the moment of fertilization. Doctors generally count pregnancy from the last missed period because it's hard to tell. You don't know when the moment of fertilization was. But when we talk about, you know, first trimester or however many weeks, medically you're talking about weeks since last missed period. So this makes everything look like it happens earlier than it actually does in common parlance. Is that, have I explained that right, Alice?
Yes. And we are seeing efforts on this front, both to make these educational mandates for students, but we're also seeing them mandated for doctors' education in some states as well. Part of this is to address what everyone on all sides acknowledges is a problem, which is that doctors don't understand when the exemptions to these abortion bans apply in terms of life and health of the parent coming into play. Oftentimes, these bans are written with non-medical language, talking about serious threats. You know, what's serious? Talking about harm to a major bodily function. What's major? You know, so you are seeing doctors holding off from providing abortions, even in cases that they think should be exempt, these emergency situations. And so anti-abortion groups are pushing these bills mandating certain curricula for doctors to try to address this confusion. The medical groups I've spoken to don't think this is a solution, but it's interesting as an attempt.
In some states, it's sort of, it has to be an affirmative defense. So as you, a doctor, consider an emergency, you perform the abortion, and then instead of not getting charged, you get charged and you have to go hire a lawyer and go to court and say, you know, I decided that this was an emergency. And that's not something that's very attractive to doctors either. And Rachel, you want to?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say, I think kind of one of the things that stuck out to me about like this particular video, one of my colleagues, Dan Rosen, so I accepted a story on in February, and he said that this is Live Action, which is, you know, the group that, you know, came under the spotlight in 2011 for releasing undercover videos seeking to discredit Planned Parenthood. But Live Action had been playing the Baby Olivia video to like legislative audiences, including like at an influential conservative group, American Legislative Exchange Council. So just kind of looking at who's kind of seeking to get this video into classrooms.
All right. Well, now it is time for our weekly dive into why healthcare costs so darn much. We begin with a fascinating and infuriating investigation from the New York Times about another one of those third-party contractors most of us had never heard of, kind of like Change Healthcare before it got hacked. This one is called MultiPlan, and its job is to recommend how much insurers and or employers in self-insured plans should pay providers. Except it turns out that MultiPlan has an incentive to pay providers less than they charge. It pockets part of the quote-unquote savings. And in most of the cases, these out-of-network charges are not covered by the surprise billing law. I think because patients know they are going out-of-network, that part is not entirely clear to me. And of course, often patients have no other available provider, so they have no choice but to go out of network. Sometimes, indeed, providers do overcharge outrageously. We've talked about that a lot. But in this case, it seems that a lot of these recommendations are to underpay outrageously. The firm told one therapist that her fair payment should be half of what Medicaid pays. Medicaid, traditionally the lowest payer of everyone. I feel like this story's going to have legs, as they say. Apparently, the American Hospital Association has already asked the U.S. Department of Labor to investigate MultiPlan. Why do I feel like we're all pawns in this huge competition between healthcare providers and insurers about who can pay who less or more and pocket the differences?
Yeah, I think we first heard about MultiPlan kind of in the conversation around surprise billing, because that was just a different category of these out-of-network bills where patients were getting stuck in the middle. And I think over time, we've seen more stories come out about, you know, loopholes and those protections. And this is another example where, you know, MultiPlan is, you know, they have to fix their business model. And the arbitration process for these surprise bills is so backed up, you know, in these certain cases, which are more emergency care, I think. And if patients don't necessarily have like control or knowledge of their provider being out of network. But certainly, like people, if you're looking for a certain specialist or like want to go to a certain place to have a procedure done, then you may just elect an out-of-network provider. And I think the part I found really interesting about this reporting that I think we've seen reflected in like larger trends on business reporting is kind of really understanding these business models better and the incentives. And I love the graphics, I think, where you're showing that, you know, if MultiBling can lowball these providers and manage to squeeze a little bit more of a discount for payers, then they're taking, you know, a cut of that discount, and patients, you know, can be left on the hook for these too. So I think, as with anything, these price billing protections are going to be an iterative process. And certainly I think there's more to be done in so many different individual cases to protect patients from some of these games that providers and insurers are engaged in, and the firms that are that kind of specialize in brokering these negotiations.
It feels very whack-a-mole every time they sort of put a band-aid on one problem, another one pops up. That it's just sort of, you know, this is what happens when a fifth of your economy goes to healthcare, is that everybody says, oh, I can make money doing X. And then there's an awful lot of people making money doing X, which is not necessarily having anything to do with providing or receiving medical care.
Absolutely. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, I think MultiPlan, it may be publicly traded as well. So if you look at some of these incentives here to kind of meet those quarterly targets and how that aligns with patients, I think that's also just something to keep in mind.
And there was private equity involved on both sides too, which I didn't even want to try to explain. You should really read the story, which is really very complicated and very well explained, because this is how it works. They make it complicated so you can't figure out what's going on. Well, meanwhile, in a sad payment story of the week, a new study has found that paying off people's medical debt doesn't actually fix their financial problems. According to a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper, paying off debts that have already gone to collection did not improve the financial status of the people who owed the money, nor their mental health, nor did it make it more likely that they would be able to pay future medical bills. One thing it did do was help their credit ratings. The researchers said that they hope maybe paying off debt before it reaches the collection status might be more helpful, but that would also be more expensive. What makes it easy to pay off medical debt after it's gone to collections is they sell it for pennies on the dollar. And of course, the U.S. is already moving towards taking medical debt off of people's credit report. So obviously, you know, we're talking about patients getting stuck with these huge bills and they end up with this medical debt. And now we can't seem to figure out how to fix the medical debt problem either.
When I first saw the study, obviously I trust that Sarah Cliff vetted her studies, but I, you know, scrolled right down to the conflict of interest section to see who funded this. And yeah, it was a very depressing study. But I think it's important to keep in mind that a failure to pay medical debt is like a symptom of larger economic problems. Like certainly there may be cases where medical debt is like the only outstanding debt somebody has, or, you know, it's like a shocking surprise, or it's like a lien on their home, you know, something like that, that might have just these massive consequences. But I think one of the points that that was brought up in the story was that when you have medical debt, sure, you have like collections calls, you have bad impact on your credit, but you're not getting like evicted from your home. And we've heard about cases where providers, you know, have held outstanding balances against patients, but I don't think that's like a general practice. You know, you're supposed to be seen if you go in for medical care. So I think just like the day-to-day challenges of poverty, of debt, you know, are so overwhelming that it is a little discouraging to hear that these individual payments may not have, you know, changed someone's life. But I think there may be like anecdotal cases that would be different from that larger trend. But it was not an encouraging study. So.
No. And speaking of conflict of interest, there was the opposite of conflict of interest. It was conducted in part by the group RIP Medical Debt, which was created to help pay off people's medical debt. And they did say, obviously, there are cases in which this does make huge differences in individual people's lives. It was just that overall, apparently, the model by which they are paying off people's debt is not helping them as much as I guess they had hoped to. So they have to look on to other things. Moving on to this week in health data security, or lack thereof, it seems that another another cyber attack group is trying to get Change Healthcare to pay ransom. This is after the company reportedly paid $22 million. So it seems that after paying, the company didn't get all of its stolen records back. Meanwhile, it seems that even though we're not hearing as much about this as we were, there are still lots of providers that aren't getting paid. I mean, Rachel, this thing, as we predicted, has a really long tail.
Absolutely does. Yeah, I think, you know, so we're seeing these like multiple ransomware groups trying to extort money out of UnitedHealthcare. I mean, they have deep pockets. It's such a mess. Like, I think, you know, who's to say what's true about what data they have as well? So it's kind of hard to report on these kind of things. And I think only UnitedHealthcare has the answers to those questions. But I think we are going to see some more like congressional oversight on this issue. I know providers, hospitals, and physician groups were absolutely using these arguments on Capitol Hill during the appropriations negotiations. They're saying we're in such financial distress, going to their lawmakers, talking about how it wouldn't be a good idea to cut provider payments or implement site neutral payments for hospitals, you know, all these long-term things that lawmakers have been thinking about. There were other political problems too, but I think it's definitely seeped into Washington, like how difficult this has been, how cumbersome some of the workarounds are for providers, large and small, I think, who are trying to work around this fiasco.
Yeah, I read one story. I mean, it really does feel like a spy movie that, you know, that they're assuming that maybe the company that got the ransom that was supposed to split it with the company that actually did the hacking didn't and made off with the money. And now the company that actually did the hacking is trying to get its own ransom. And oh my goodness, I mean, again, this is what happens when a fifth of the economy goes through the healthcare system. But I mean, I want to keep on this story because this story really does keep on impacting the backroom goings on, which keep the healthcare system functioning in some ways. And while we are on the subject of healthcare data breaches, USA Today has now a searchable tool for you to find out if you're one of the 144 million Americans whose medical information was stolen or exposed in the last year. Yay, I think. I suppose this is a necessary evil. It's hard for me to imagine, you know, 10 years ago, it's like, wow, you can take some time and find out if your medical information's been exposed.
It's better than not knowing because, you know, you can change your passwords, you can do some credit monitoring, you could protect your information in some ways, but it's not the same as better protections for the breaches happening in the first place.
And I know Congress is talking about a privacy bill, but apparently it is in truly embryonic stages at this point, because don't think Congress really knows what to do about this either. They just know that they probably should do something. All right, that is the news for this week. Now we will play my Bill of the Month interview with Molly Work. Then we will come back and do our extra credits. I am pleased to welcome to the podcast my colleague Molly Work, who reported and wrote the latest KFF Health News NPR Bill of the Month installment. Molly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Julie.
So this month's bill, like last month's bill, is for an air ambulance ride, a bill that should have been prevented by the federal No Surprises Act, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, who is our patient this month?
So our patient is Amari Vaca. He was a three-month-old baby at the time from Salinas, California.
And what happened to him?
When Amari was a three-month-old baby, he had issues with his breathing. His mother took him to the local ER. And pretty quickly, his team of doctors decided that he needed more specialized care at a larger hospital in San Francisco. So they organized an emergency transport.
Via helicopter, yes?
It was actually by air ambulance, so like a small airplane.
Ah, okay. And before we get too far, he's okay now, right?
Yes, he is okay. Unfortunately, he was transported to the hospital. He was there for 3 weeks. They diagnosed him with RSV, but he's fortunately doing well now.
Well, and then, as we say, the bill came. And how much was it?
It was $97,599.
Of which the insurance paid how much?
Zero.
Now, as I mentioned at the top, the federal surprise billing law should have prevented the patient from getting a big bill like this, except it didn't in this case. So why not?
Yeah, so this was really interesting. Cigna, which was Amari's health plan at the time, decided that the care was not medically necessary. Their argument was that he could have taken a ground ambulance. There was nothing to prove that he had to take this emergency airplane. And so because of this, Cigna was able to avoid No Surprises Act, and they didn't pay for any of the bill.
And therefore, the patient was left on the hook.
Yes. Amari and his family were left on the hook for the entire bill.
So this feels like something that should have been taken care of with a phone call. The insurer calls the doctor and says, hey, why'd you order an air ambulance when the hospital's only 100 miles away? And the doctor says, because it was an infant on a ventilator. But that would have been too easy, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of issues with this. Like, first off, one of the best things about No Surprises Act is it's supposed to take patients out of this. It's supposed to make it so health plans and providers deal with all these negotiations before it even goes to a patient. But because of how this was handled, instead, Amari's family is having to do all these negotiations. They're the ones who are writing letters using his medical records to Cigna and doing multiple appeals.
And so far, has there been any progress or is the bill still outstanding?
It's still outstanding. His mother, Sarah, has done 2 internal appeals. So that means she applied to have the bill changed within Cigna. They denied her both times. Right now, she's working on an external appeal where an outside provider helps evaluate, and she's still waiting to hear back on that.
So what's the takeaway here? I mean, obviously, you know, you take your critically ill child to a hospital and they say he has to go. He needs a higher level of care and recommends an air ambulance. Are you supposed to say, wait, I have to call my insurer first to make sure they're not going to deem this medically unnecessary?
Yeah, that's what's so frustrating, because obviously, if any of us were in that situation, we would have done the same thing. If our baby was sick, we would do the emergency air ambulance. Or we would do what the doctors told us to do. I think what I've been hearing from people is that, first off, hospitals should become better acquainted with what plans cover. Of course, we can only hope. But like the hospital, for example, should have checked which air ambulance providers are covered by Cigna before they made the call, because the one they did call was out of network for Amari's family. As patients, what you can really do is you just need to advocate for yourself. It's easy to be intimidated, but there are lots of times that hospitals just get the medical bill wrong, or insurance companies. So do what Sarah is doing and appeal. If internal appeals don't work, go push for that external appeal as well.
Yes. These days, it helps to know your rights and to try to exercise them when you have them. Mm-hmm. Molly Work, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Julie.
Okay, we're back. It's time for our extra credit segment. That's when we each recommend a story we read this week we think you should read too. As always, don't worry if you miss it. We will post the links on the podcast page at kffhealthnews.org and in our show notes on your phone or other mobile device. Rachel Zhang, why don't you go first this week? Yep, we have both Rachels.
Yes, confusing. So I chose a story in KFF Health News, actually, and the headline is 10 doctors on FDA panel reviewing Abbott heart device had financial ties with the company. And I think this was just a really illuminating explanation of some of the loopholes in conflict of interest disclosures with FDA advisory committees. There's a lot of controversy over what role these committees should play, when they should meet, but we're seeing them play some very high profile roles in drug approvals as well. But we have a medical device reporter, you know, on our team, and we just think it's such an important coverage area as we're looking at the money that the medical device industry spends. And I mean, you're looking at some of these advisory board members who've received unopened payments, $200,000 from this company, and they're not disclosing it because it's not directly related to this individual device. And I think it's fair to say that some of them argued, you know, it was for a clinical study. The university got the money. You know, I wasn't spending it on a fancy car or something. But nonetheless, I think there's a good argument in this piece for some more stringent requirements for conflict of interest, especially if this data is publicly available.
Yes, I was kind of taken this week about how very many good stories there were about investigations into conflicts of interest. Speaking of which, other Rachel, why don't you go next?
My extra credit this week is titled As Obesity Rises, Big Food and Dietitians Push Anti-Diet Advice. And it's a joint investigation by The Washington Post and The Examination, which is a new nonprofit newsroom that's specializing in global health. And I thought it was a really fascinating window into the food industry and its practices at a time when the FDA and its commissioner wants to crack down, make front of package labeling more prevalent. And so basically the story dives into kind of this anti-diet movement, which began as an effort to combat weight stigma and unhealthy obsession with thinness. And the movement has now become kind of a behemoth on social media. And basically, like, food marketers are kind of trying to cash in here. The story kind of focused on one company in particular, General Mills, and its cereal. And the investigation found that the company launched a multi-pronged campaign to capitalize on the anti-diet movement and giveaways to registered dietitians who promote the cereals online. And I just thought it was kind of a fascinating exploration of all of these dynamics.
Yes, good journalism at work. Alice.
Yeah, I have a story from the Texas Tribune by Eleanor Klibanoff about the impact of the court ruling that said that Title X federal family planning clinics that all across the country have a policy of dispensing contraception, prescribing contraception to teens, whether or not they have parental consent, and doing that in a advancing privacy and protecting them in that way. There was just a recent court ruling that said just in Texas, the state's parental consent laws override that. And they found that at a lot of these clinics, instances of teens coming in and seeking contraception have really fallen off. These are teens, the story documents, who don't feel comfortable going to their parents. There's instances of parents even getting violent with their kids when they find out about this. And so it really shows the effect of this. And this is something we should be continuing to track because it went to the Fifth Circuit and it could go to the Supreme Court. We don't know yet.
Yeah, we talked about this case a couple of weeks ago. It was another of those cases that was very much aimed at a particular judge that they were confident would rule in their favor, who indeed did rule in their favor. All right, well, my extra credit this week is not an investigation. It's just a story I really liked from Stat News from Rachel's colleague, Sarah Overmull. And it's called Your Dog is Probably on Prozac. Experts say that says more about the American mental health crisis than pets. And full disclosure, that is one of my dogs in the background messing with the bone. My dog are not on Prozac, but I am, and we are all three the better for it. It's a serious story, though, about how our mental health impacts that of our pets, not just vice versa, and about how so few new medicines there are for anxiety and depression. And as an officer of a dog training club, I will say that it's more than humans' projections. We are definitely seeing more dogs with behavioral issues than at any time that I can remember, and I've owned dogs all my life. Okay, that is our show. As always, if you enjoy the podcast, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you left us a review. That helps other people find us too. Special thanks, as always, to our technical guru, Francis Ying, and our editor, Emery Hudeman. As always, you can email us your comments or questions. We're at whatthehealthalloneword@kff.org. You can still find me mostly at X at J. Robner. Alice, where are you these days?
I'm at Alice Holstein on X and at Alice Miranda on Blue Sky.
Rachel Tang.
I'm at Rachel Kors on X and also spending more time on LinkedIn these days.
Rachel Rubine.
Rachel_Rubine on X.
We will be back in your feed next week. Until then, be healthy.